Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is called to order. Good morning, everyone. We're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 415. We'll do a quick briefing here. I think Kyle's going to give us a quick briefing, and then we'll call up Senators Mona Sanderson and Senator Hayward. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 415, the engrossed version. What it will do is it prohibits distributing or selling or allowing to be sold flavored tobacco products in Oregon. And it defines flavored tobacco products as a tobacco product or a component of a tobacco product manufactured to impart characterizing flavor. The bill defines characterizing flavor as distinguishable taste or aroma other than tobacco or menthol. It allows the Oregon Health Authority to impose a civil penalty of up to $5,000 for each violation and directs proceeds of civil penalties to the OHA fund, permits OHA to adopt rules, and allows OHA to adopt rules concerning random inspection of places that distribute tobacco products consistent with federal law or regulation relating to inspection. And it also allows the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to assist OHA in their enforcement duties, declares an emergency and is effective on passage. And just as a note, I would mention there's a couple in the meeting materials in OLIS. I included a comparison of the states and the OTP taxes, so you can see that for the 50 states. And then also there's a document describing the federal ban on flavored products and cigarettes. So there's a document from the FDA that talks about, so at the federal side on the cigarettes, there's a ban on flavorings other than menthol and tobacco. But just for some background information, that information is available in OLIS.
Okay, this chart that you have up here.
Yeah.
Can you give us the significance of how this relates to the flavor?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I mean, it's really a comparison. I highlighted, I don't know if it came up in the document, if it came up in color, but highlighted the different states surrounding Oregon. So Washington's a little bit higher, and then Idaho and California are lower. But with OTP, it can be a little bit different, too, on how things are taxed. On general, for Oregon, it's 65% of wholesale price. But there is, for moist snuff, it's a little different based upon the size of what's being sold. So there's a bit of a floor. And then for cigars, there's a 50-cent cap. And that's primarily because the price of cigars, there can be some pretty high-end cigars. So applying a wholesale tax, there's a cap amount there. But for what I included in some of the background information, what's also in the revenue light, as this bill came out of Senate Committee on Health Care, including the revenue light so that the measure could pass out of there and come to this committee, was a description of the market share, really, of other tobacco products. So depending upon the product, the way the bill's written, what would be considered flavored can make up a vast different market share. So for moist snuff, you're looking at a little over half of the market share would be considered flavor. Primarily that's wintergreen or mint flavored, with some of the, you know, the flavorings, you think of banana or some of those, representing about 5%. On the hand-rolled cigar market, it's relatively small for the high-end hand-rolled cigars, but there's also a number of flavored cigars. So in that case, it could, depends how you break the market up, really. And then for shisha tobacco or hookah tobacco, it's nearly all of those products are flavored. So just to give some sense of what the impact would be, I suppose, of the measure.
But did you happen to look at what states, if any other states, do something like what this bill proposes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the, I don't believe any states have imposed anything similar to this. It has been discussed in Washington State. I know they've had a couple bills, but nothing's passed. We have seen this at the municipality level. New York City is probably the biggest example of putting a ban on flavorings of other tobacco products. But I believe, I'll reference the notes here real quick. In New York City, they did put, they have a list of flavorings, and I can provide this document that I'm looking at here on OLIS, but they did, for things that were not considered flavor, or their flavors that are allowed, are menthol, mint, wintergreen, and tobacco. So they have kind of a list of ones that are not allowed, such as fruit, chocolate, vanilla, honey, and so forth. But the two kind of the largest shares of at least the moist snuff flavoring, which would be mint and wintergreen, are allowed. So they kind of removed those, similar to at the federal level for flavorings of cigarettes. They allowed menthol, which would be a flavoring, but they did allow that one, which makes up a rather large share of cigarettes at that market. but there are a few other, I think, small municipalities throughout that have done something similar to this, but New York City is definitely the largest.
Okay, and we have two senators here, Senator Montes Anderson and Senator Steiner Hayward. I love it when you get together because we have two senators with a total of four last names.
We try, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale Village, and Fairview. We had a very robust conversation with Senate Bill 415 and then made the decision to amend it significantly to really ban flavored tobacco products. And we had discussed about the inhalant delivery system. We decided that we would not ban the flavoring on that. The research isn't quite there yet. And I think, as your staff said, under the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, the sale of flavored cigarettes was made illegal in September 2009. I believe strongly that eliminating flavored tobacco products is just one more way to eliminate a cancer-causing product in our society. They have become very common in the United States, and these products like vanilla, orange, chocolate, cherry, and coffee are especially attractive to youth also, and they will attract smoking habits that can lead to a lifetime of addiction. And as a public health nurse, that's what I want to focus on making sure that these flavored products are especially kept out of the hands of children. Youth like flavored products, and the tobacco industry has a clear pattern of designing flavored products that are geared toward our youth. They are all addictive with nicotine in it and carry the same health risks as an estimated 443,000 Americans die prematurely each year due to smoking and exposure to secondhand smoke. And these are more deaths than all the deaths from HIV, illegal drug use, alcohol use, motor vehicle injuries, suicides, and murders combined. So smoking causes many types of cancers, as well as heart disease and chronic lung diseases like emphysema. And I urge you to at least keep the policy. I don't understand the revenue that you are discussing here, but I am giving you the option to do whatever you want with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from Northwest Portland and Beaverton, also a family physician. I, too, urge your support for Senate Bill 415 in its amended form. As a family physician, I would echo everything that Senator Montes Anderson said about the public health issues surrounding flavored tobacco. And we know that in particular, when we think about these in terms of chewing tobacco and these little pouches that I don't know the names of that they have now, those are the things that sit in people's mouths. They like the flavors because they taste better, but they still get the nicotine. But they sit there for hours, and the rate of oral cancers is rising in people using these products, and that's an incredibly dangerous prospect. Those are hard cancers to treat. They're disfiguring, they're life impairing, and they certainly shorten people's lives. The last thing we want is to have a line of products available that are specifically targeting younger people to use these products, and as Senator Montes Anderson said, to result in a lifetime of addiction. We are stuck, frankly, in what you and I, Senator Hass, discussed as a Faustian bargain. Tobacco taxes, we know, reduce use, right? Kids in particular are very price sensitive. So the higher the price of tobacco products, the less use there is. And even adults tend to cut back as prices go up. And that's a good thing. But when the state becomes dependent on tobacco revenue to fund various programs, we get stuck in a really difficult place. I don't know that I completely believe. I'm not doubting the staff of LRO by any means, but I don't know that I'm completely convinced that the revenue impact is going to be as high as is initially estimated. And I urge you to take a look at what happened in New York City. We forwarded you information, and I'm sure your capable staff can help with that as well. I don't think New York saw anywhere near the anticipated tax impact when it banned these flavored products. And ultimately, Mr. Chair, a short-term revenue loss is better than the lives that we will lose and the cost that we will incur by continuing to allow these products to be sold and creating new generations of tobacco users. These are really, really dangerous products, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I urge you to recognize that the short-term pain of some revenue loss is well worth the long-term gain of community health and well-being and preventing children from becoming addicted. Thank you very much. Happy to take any questions.
Questions for two senators here?
Couple of questions.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this include all forms of tobacco? Does it include pipe tobacco, premium cigars?
Yes.
Okay.
But it does still allow, Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, it does still allow the mint and menthol flavors that are currently allowed for cigarettes. Those are not prohibited. By this, it only prohibits all these other fruit and bubble gum and honey and chocolate and things like that.
Where is that in the bill that allows mint?
I don't have it in front of me. I can pull it up.
It's menthol.
You got it?
I think that is the word.
Yeah, it's only menthol.
Section 1A.
Other than tobacco or menthol.
Line 6.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm 7.
Mint Thank is you. Not included, just menthol.
Other than tobacco or menthol.
Okay. Senator Edwards?
That was it for now. Thank you.
No questions. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And my apologies, committee. I've got to go be in another committee.
I'll just go down this list. We have a few people. John Calder from Marion County. Come on up, sir.
Hello, I'm John Calder, and I've been using tobacco products for 62 years this coming July. And I am not ill due to smoking. I do have a slight bit of COPD, which is a breathing condition. And I own a smoke shop, and I'm very much against this bill for two reasons. It has nothing to do with children. It's just one of the things that some of these people want you to believe. I started smoking because my parents smoked, and that's the way most all children start smoking, is because their peers. Not because of advertisements or whatever. And as far as the flavored and tobacco products go, you can walk into any grocery store and buy flavoring, which is using cakes, candies, whatever, and put it in your tobacco or in your inhalers. You can also buy sprays to spray your loose tobacco. And that's how the flavoring got started in the tobacco industry, was people would buy these sprays or buy the little bottles of juice out of the grocery store and flavor it themselves. We can go back to that if you want to stop it. But why? You know, it's not going to change anything. If a parent smokes, or a peer smokes, or somebody the kids look up to, the kids are going to smoke. I've got 5 daughters. One of them has smoked for over 20 years. 2 of them tried smoking for a short period of time and quit. So I've got 1 daughter that is addicted to tobacco. And I guess that's all, except I would like to say these commercials that the antis put on draws the kids into buying the product or swiping the product or using the product. Thank you. Have you got any questions for me?
We'll see. No, sir. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Let me call up what I'll call a panel of Richard Kosasan, Justin Rainey, and Paul Cosgrove.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Richard Kosenbaum, and I represent the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, predominantly representing small, independent convenience stores. What I was going to try to do, since this is the Revenue Committee, is talk about the financial implications of a flavor ban. The total category of other tobacco product receipts, for example, in the 2013-2014 fiscal year in Oregon totaled $56,370,000. And if you use that as a base, moist snuff represents about 80% of that category.
Excuse me. Is that better?
Yep.
Nice. Cigars would represent about 10%, and in terms of all other products, loose leaf, etc., pipe tobacco would represent the remaining 10%. The revenue distribution of that $56.3 million, $53.84 goes to the general fund, 41.54% is dedicated to the health plan, and 4.62% is dedicated to the tobacco use reduction account. I looked at numbers in terms of retail sector as well as wholesale sector, and in terms of flavored product, about 55% of what is on the market in terms of moist snuff, again comprising 80% of those receipts, is what one would be determined as flavored. Cigars, you're probably in the neighborhood of 75 to 85%. In terms of all other, I used a very conservative estimate of 25%. If those were banned in the state of Oregon, you would have a loss in terms of general fund dollars of about $24.8 million, to the health plan about $10.3 million. Those numbers would be representative of the moist snuff category. In terms of cigars, you're down probably $4.7 million. For the general fund, to the health plan, about $1.9 million. All other, you have an impact of about $1.4 million, and to the health plan, about $585,000. So if you, I think, use those numbers, again, representing retail categories and wholesale categories, your impact in the 15-17 biennium, I think, would be on a conservative side, again, using the 13-14 fiscal year numbers, in the neighborhood of $60 to $62 million. I think the other part that needs to be looked at is the cross-border implications. If you take a look at Washington State and Oregon State, because of the tax differential and the sales tax in Washington State, you're literally selling about twice as much product in Oregon as you are in Washington on a per capita basis. If you took those and suggested the demographics are similar and blended those consumption rates and used that average off of what Oregon was selling in the last two-year period, you would lose about $13.5 million in terms of the estimated flavor exemption. That would total about $7.5 million. So there's direct implications in terms of the flavor ban, but I think the cross-border implications are very, very interesting. With that, I'll let these other two gentlemen go and be happy to try to answer any questions.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Rainey. I'm here today on behalf of Reynolds American. Reynolds American is the second largest manufacturer of cigarettes in the United States. We're opposed to Senate Bill 415. As I read the bill, Section 1A would not exempt wintergreen or mint type flavors. And that's part of the reason we have such a high fiscal impact. Reynolds American, we make electronic cigarette. We also make moist stuff and chew. Our electronic cigarette, Vuse, only comes in two flavors. It's the traditional flavor, and then it's a menthol flavor. So that wouldn't have been impacted by any of the bills considered. The second, we make different brands of chew and moist snuff, but they only use the wintergreen or a mint variant flavor. So we don't use any flavoring in our products. So we're strongly concerned with the impact this legislation would have on our product, but also the product that our customers have used for years. This is a bill that targets adults, we feel. All of our products are sold behind counters with retailers that comply with the We Card Under 18 program. We're concerned with the impact this will have on the budget. We agree with the numbers that the Oregon Neighborhood Stores Association has brought forward and the potential impact that that would have. I mean, I think to recap, you have a loss of roughly $62 million to the general fund, and I think it's roughly $23 million of that would be lost to the Oregon Health Plan. And the other part that we think is really important is you'd be losing nearly $3 million of funds that currently go to the tobacco use reduction account. I think one of the strongest things we can do in reaching out to individuals who choose to use this product based on evidence of their peers or family members is educating both the parents, family members, and the youth of the harms of the products that they're consuming so that they're well aware of the risks. So we feel that this legislation hurts Oregon consumers that currently are using these products that are intended for individuals, adult individuals. We think that the education and prevention dollars would also have a significant impact. I do want to close by saying in New York, New York City under Mayor Bloomberg, they did do an exemption, but they did do a flavor ban. It's the only flavor, no other state's done a flavor ban, but New York City, you know, as one of the larger cities, did enact the flavor ban, but that specifically excluded mint and wintergreen flavors. So that's why you probably haven't seen a huge financial loss in New York City, because they exempted a large amount of the product. With that, I would conclude my remarks and urge the committee to oppose Senate Bill 415.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Cigar Association of America. We represent the smallest market share of the products that Mr. Kozasan described. The 10% of the other tobacco product market is cigars. Some of our small family companies, and in contrast to cigarettes, the cigar industry is a series of small, mostly still family-owned companies, often Florida-based, often primarily or formerly Cuba-based, but now in Florida. And it's more difficult for us to get precise market data about what percentage of the market is flavored, because we're talking about a whole series of very small companies, and it's hard to gather that information. But we do agree, and in our surveys in the past, that 75 to 85% of all cigars, small and large, are flavored. And it's not just something that's new. This has been true ever since the market, the cigars were started to be produced. Some of the flavorings are, I was reminded the other day that there's a rather expensive cigar that is flavored with Maker's Mark bourbon. There are cigars flavored with rum. These are clearly adult products. They've been flavored like this for a long time, and it's a tradition. But if this bill were passed, 75 to 85% of all those products would not be available to Oregon adults. Some of our companies actually do a little bit of business in pipe tobacco, and they report that nearly 100% of pipe tobacco marketed in the United States is flavored as well, and that is also traditional. It's not a new development. It's something very old. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We agree that the figures produced by the retail and wholesale data that Mr. Kozasan had is probably the best figures we have available to help you in determining the revenue impact. Thank you very much.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, does your association distinguish between types of cigars, you know, premium cigars versus small cigars, Swisher Sweets, things like that, or is just all cigars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, clearly there are a number of small cigars that are flavored, probably a higher percentage of small cigars are flavored than large cigars.
I don't have data about the percentages of each. Small cigars in Oregon are actually taxed as cigarettes. The tax rate is different here. So, in fact, I don't know that that was taken into account in Mr. Koza's hands. It could actually increase the revenue loss if those small cigars, to the extent they're flavored, and many of them are not able to be sold. I don't have the data of what percentage big cigars are flavored. I know a bunch of them are. I know that's imprecise. And I know many of the small cigars are as well.
Okay. Well, and the reason I ask is because it seems to me that, I mean, those are very different market segments. You know, the cheap little Swisher sweets that are flavored versus premium cigars that are, you know, quite expensive sometimes, very different markets. So that's why I was asking if you make that distinction.
And you are correct. The companies tend to make some of both kinds, each of the companies, in my experience.
Senator Edwards with a working knowledge of the category.
Just for the conflict of interest, I have a working knowledge of the upper end of the market. So, Mr. Krauser, just a question, because to help LRO here in discussions in the future, I suppose. You said that there's a segment, and other tobacco products task force, I'll have to go ask Paul to, you know, smack me upside the head and remember all these things from 2005. But the small cigars, what's the break point from where the cigar is in the cigar other tobacco product market, and what's the break point below? Can you give a couple examples in terms of, you know, Swisher sweets? I mean, which are considered cigarettes and which are considered cigars? Just a little bit more defining information for Kyle here to get him educated.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Boquist, for the purposes of this bill, all of those are considered cigars. For the purposes of taxation, there's a differentiation, and I would have to actually pull up the tax statutes to recall myself what the breakpoint is. Some small cigars are taxed as cigarettes. Not all small cigars are. There is a very defined breakpoint in the tax statutes, and then all other cigars are taxed as other tobacco products. So all it does is it changes the calculation, and I'll be happy to work with LRO to try to get that definition clarified for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just if you recall, when we had the discussion about taxation of tobacco products, one of the questions I asked is, what would this save us in revenue for every dollar we taxed? And I think it's appropriate in this conversation as well. The response I got in writing later, because no one knew in the panel, but later the response was we save about $7, a little over $7 for every dollar we tax cigarettes in health care costs. And I think that is appropriate for this conversation as well.
Justin, a question for you on the New York City law. It feels like the majority of what we're talking about with Chew is the wintergreen and mint, and were they to be exempted in this bill, you would walk away from this with no problem, I assume.
Yeah, Chair House, members of the committee, if that were to happen, it would not impact our company, but we would still be opposed to banning on the flavors. We feel that adults should have the opportunity to purchase the product, especially since we have these products behind counters with age verification. So, you know, it would not impact our company, but we don't think it would be the right policy.
Questions. Thank you.
Question down here in the left.
Question. I'm sorry.
And I don't know if this is for this panel or for the proponents of the bill, but how? What's the enforcement mechanism look like? I mean, there's mention of a fine. Is it complaint driven? Is it spot checks? Is it you get your license pulled? Well, you don't have licensure, right, to sell tobacco products.
Mr. Chair and Senator Edwards, there are a variety of enforcement mechanisms. Under what is known as the Sinar Amendment, which was enacted by Congress in 1992, states were expected to pass laws that prohibit the sale and distribution to minors, to enforce such laws, and to conduct random, unannounced inspections of retailers. So that is one facet. And in 2009, the Tobacco Control Act was passed, and that set up FDA. And FDA conducts random unannounced inspections today. I think in the course of the last year, FDA conducted approximately 1,100 random unannounced inspection of retailers throughout the state. So you have kind of a dual role there, but retailers are indeed inspected.
Yeah, Senator Edwards, what's in the bill right now, it would fall on the Oregon Health Authority primarily. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission is to assist, and I think that's part of it is a number of cigars are sold in liquor establishments as well as part of that. But one thing that is, I don't know if it's missing or it's not included in this bill at least, is the enforcement and how that would work with Department of Revenue, who's interested in the tax being paid. But if they were looking from an enforcement standpoint, if the tax is paid from the Department of Revenue's viewpoint, that would be fine. But there would be no necessarily enforcement on the ban itself. So if a store or someone was selling the product, as long as they paid the tax on it, even though it's banned from the Department of Revenue standpoint, that would be okay as long as they paid the tax. It would be the OHA that would be enforcing the ban, really.
Senator Boquist.
Boy, did we just open Pandora's box here. I think, Mr. Chair, we need a little clarification here from the Department of Revenue in the future, because we have, under the other tobacco products, we have spot checks, and I'm looking for Mr. Warner, unless something's changed since 2005. I mean, again, we spent, I think, $31 million out of their hide, supposedly trying to track down other tobacco products and smuggling, of which I was intimately part of, which was a total disaster for $31 million. But we have revenue agents, I guess for a better word, whatever we call our guys, going in and checking the tax stamps, so on and so forth, and making sure the tax is there. I would assume, and I would think, that if an agency of the state government goes in and finds someone violating the law, that their position won't be, oh, we don't care they're violating the law, we just want money. I think that's called corruption. So I think we need a little clarification from the Department of Revenue, because I don't think that's really their official position. And if it is, then we obviously need some discussions with the governor. Because, and my concern is the same as I think as Senator Edwards. I'm just trying to figure out, let's say you did do this, who's going to enforce it? Are we now going to create a new bureaucracy when we already have the revenue agents going in here? So I'm not sure if we did this, who's supposed to do it, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to create a new agency to double down on this thing if it's a taxation issue. But I think we should seek clarification, Mr. Chair.
We will do that. Thank you, gentlemen. Before we get to that, thank you.
Thank you.
I want to call up another panel. Karen Gerard, Sarah Higginbottom, and Jen Baker, please.
Good morning, Senator Haas, members of the committee. My name is Karen Gerard. I am the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Section Manager at the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here today to testify about Senate Bill 415 concerning flavored tobacco. Addiction to tobacco starts in adolescence. In fact, 9 of 10 adults report that they started smoking before they turned age 18. And kids in Oregon are under constant pressure to start using tobacco. Tobacco products are enticing our kids, even at the earliest ages. Tobacco products are sweet, cheap, and easy to get, and they're often placed at a child's eye level near the candy in stores. And like candy, tobacco products come in bright packaging and a variety of flavors. In 2009, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration banned the use of flavor additives to cigarettes as an important step in preventing children and adolescents from starting to smoke. And although cigarettes can no longer contain flavors other than menthol or tobacco, the FDA regulation does not apply to other tobacco products. Like little cigars, chewing tobacco, hookah tobacco, and moist snuff. These non-cigarette tobacco products still come in a variety of flavors, including peach, strawberry, and grape. The appeal of these flavored products is represented in the data that we collect on tobacco use behaviors among Oregon youth. While approximately 9% of 11th graders in Oregon smoke cigarettes, about 18% of 11th graders use other tobacco products, including cigars, hookah, and chew. While the shapes, sizes, packaging, and modes of ingestion vary for these products, what they all have in common is their availability in a variety of flavors. Flavors mask the natural harshness and taste of tobacco, making flavored tobacco products easier to use and increasing their appeal among youth. According to Portland State University researchers, flavor additives that are being used to sweeten tobacco products are the same as those used in Lifesavers and Kool-Aid. These types of fruit, candy, and dessert flavors appeal to kids and young people who report that they use these tobacco products with flavors over unflavored tobacco because they taste better. Flavored tobacco use is also an issue of equity. The use of flavored products among tobacco users enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan is 20% higher than tobacco users who are privately insured. Flavored tobacco use is 52% higher among tobacco users who live in low-income households compared to tobacco users in higher-income households. The Public Health Division appreciates this committee addressing flavored tobacco use in Oregon and the opportunity to testify today, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Thanks. We'll go through the rest.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Jen Baker, testifying on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association in support of Senate Bill 415. ONA has long been an active partner in Oregon's tobacco prevention efforts and has worked with this body to help reduce the cost of tobacco and nicotine addiction on the state, and we see that this bill aligns very nicely with the work that we've done together in the past. As Karen mentioned, the flavoring is particularly attractive to children. There are a lot of statistics around that that she mentioned. I won't go into all of that, but I will touch on the Sidenour Amendment, which is, as you heard earlier, the enforcement mechanism for ensuring that tobacco products are not sold to minors here in the state. And Oregon consistently ranks in the bottom on outcomes of stings of the Sidenour enforcement and is at risk of losing federal funding for addiction and mental health services as a result of that ranking. And I'll also point your attention to the roughly $20 million of tobacco prevention investment that this legislature made last session. I point all that out to say that I think that any revenue that the state may lose as a result of banning flavored tobacco products will certainly be offset more in the benefit of preventing young Oregonians from becoming addicted to tobacco and nicotine for life. Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Higginbotham, and I'm here representing the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association. And we support Senate Bill 415. It's been 50 years since the U.S. Surgeon General issued its first warning about the harms of tobacco, and today we're still fighting those same issues. But the good news is we know a lot more than we did 50 years ago. We know what policies work, and we know when people become addicted. We know that 90% of adult smokers start before the age of 18, and that 98% of them start before age 26. I'll just highlight a few things that hopefully haven't already been said. As Karen mentioned, in 2009, and as you've already heard, the federal government banned flavored cigarettes. However, what happened was the industry modified their flavored cigarettes to meet the legal definition of cigars, which committee members have mentioned some concern about already, and continued to market them like sweet flavors. The most popular cigar brands among youth come in a wide variety of flavors like chocolate, cherry, strawberry, grape, and lemonade, as well as with catchy names that appeal to children, such as blueberry, pinkberry, and banana split. Between 2000 and 2013, cigar consumption increased by 114%, while cigarette consumption declined by 37%. Consider the recent rise in cigar use among adolescents. Every day, more than 2,700 youth try cigar smoking for the first time, making cigars one of the most commonly used products among youth, second only to cigarettes. Much of this increase in cigar use can be attributed to the availability of flavored cigars. I'll just cite a Maryland Youth Tobacco Survey that found 76% of cigar users in high school smoked flavored cigars with less than 2%, while less than 2% of adults actually do. We believe that Senate Bill 415 would protect Oregon's youth and that there is clear evidence that flavored cigars, just like flavored cigarettes, are attractive to youth and have led to increased initiation and use among adolescents. characterizing flavors should only be allowed if manufacturers can prove that flavored tobacco products do not appeal to youth, that the flavors are safe and that they have been tested. We urge the legislature to act quickly to stop the tobacco industry from initiating a new generation of smokers. I'll just highlight one final statistic for you, which is that as of today, 213,400 of Oregon's kids will become smokers, and 68,000 of those kids who are initiated into smoking will die prematurely. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Start down there.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, you rattled off a couple of statistics before the end of your testimony, and I didn't catch them. Use of tobacco products is blank percent of the OHP population, and then I think you said something about the flavored, a distinction in flavored products as well.
Senator House, Senator Edwards, the use of flavored products among the Oregon Health Plan, enrolled Oregon Health Plan, is 20% higher than tobacco users who are privately insured, and flavored tobacco use is 52% higher among tobacco users who live in lower income neighborhoods.
Thank you. Senator Bokwist.
Thank you. I'm writing real quick here. Follow up, sort of the same questions I had earlier, but I don't disagree with Senator Riley in terms of the savings that we see. However, this is revenue, and then we have joint ways and means, so that's the topic here. Senator Riley mentioned 7-to-1 savings, and I don't even think you need to comment on that in terms of, you know, what it is. I guess my real question is that we know that if there's a decrease, that there's a savings. The question is when do we realize the savings? So this is both a revenue and a joint ways and means question. You know, if we cut now, when does the effect take place? Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think we're going to have a tough time convincing the co-chairs of Ways and Means that if we cut $52 billion or whatever the magic number is here, that revenue comes up, and we say, well, you don't need that. You can take it from OHA. That ain't going to work. So what's the timeline here for our education purposes?
Senator Haas, Senator Bokwist, we can get back to you with that information, but it would certainly vary from users that might quit using the product to children who would never start and become addicted in the first place. But we'd be happy to get back to you with that information.
Well, question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bokwist.
On the other side, back to my pet peeve, since I was instrumental in the waste of $31 million, thinking that we could actually do something here back in 2005, we went from revenue agents trying to do this, and then we got the OLCC involved, and then we've previously gotten the Oregon Health Authority involved, and I think it was mentioned that we ranked pretty poorly in terms of trying to do sting in law enforcement. Except the Oregon Health Authority is supposed to coordinate with law agencies to conduct random unannounced inspections of wholesalers and retails today. So what do we do different that we're doing today? Don't worry, I asked this in 2005, too. And I wasted $31 million, by the way. What do we do different? What does OHA do different today? Or what does revenue do different today? Or what does OLCC do different today based on your colleague to the right just saying we do this so poorly, but it's your agency that's involved in doing this poorly? So how do we change?
Senator Haas, Senator Bokwist, I will need to get back to you on what we do differently today among those agencies, but I will say that we are meeting regularly as a group to talk about ways that we can improve retail inspections in Oregon and improve on that rate going forward.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. From OHA's perspective, and you guys can huddle if you want to, because we said we risk losing federal matching money. Can you give a little explanation when you follow up of what are we risking on federal matching money because we're doing this enforcement so poorly? Because you see, this is a pet peeve of me going back for 10 years. So.
Senator Haas, Senator Bokwist, I will need to get back to you on that. That program is run out of the Addictions and Mental Health Division, and so I don't have that information with me.
Sarah.
If I may, I'll be brief. Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, Oregon is also one of the only states in the country. There are a few others that does not, and this issue is not something your committee handles, but it does not require retail licensure for tobacco retailers, which has been attributed with one of the high rates of sales to minors in Oregon and why Oregon continually ranks as one of the worst in the country.
Thank you.
Senator Bartschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess first thing, I want to make clear that I would, you know, never encourage anybody to use tobacco products. Obviously, there's some, but there's a lot of things that we do that aren't good for you. You know, we eat too much, you're out in the sun too much. So, but I'm not going to get into those, you know, free choice conversation. But I look at the enforcement conversation. I mean, we're getting ready to roll out a marijuana regulation, powdered alcohol regulation. I don't know where we're going to find this money to regulate all of this and address all the issues that I have a funny feeling in a couple of years this is going to be way down on the priority list. I just have a funny feeling. So I you know, looking at it from a regulatory standard, you know, if you can't regulate it, why are we passing these types of laws?
Thank you. Thank you. Well, Senator Riley made a good point that Brian Boquist went to, too, about the cost. When do we start to see the savings? And it occurs to me it's not all a quantitative equation here. There's also, I should say, there is a qualitative equation where someone doesn't get addicted to tobacco and lives a healthy life, maybe lives 20 years longer. You won't ever see that show up in any balance sheet or a budget, and it's very hard to figure that into the calculation or the policy calculus, Senator Boquist.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I'm either opposed or either gray on the previous topic, and maybe these younger people have a better idea than what we had 10 years ago, but I mean, I think I'm with you, and that is we need to figure out what is a comprehensive plan here and what's the long-term plan, because we know what we've done for the last decade ain't working. So I'm either for a ban or against a ban. I'm either for a tax or back. It's just, you know, having spent an inordinate amount of time in two sessions on this, there's got to be a better way to figure out how to keep kids off of this, you know, while protecting some of the freedoms and figuring out long-term how we reduce health costs, because we are going to go broke over health care. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I agree. We need to look at a long-term solution. But while we're looking for that long-term solution, I don't think we should be ignoring the short-term ones as well.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. I think that's all I have signed up on the sheet here to testify on this bill. Is there anyone else who wants to come forward? Tobacco industry, sending anyone forward? Okay. Then we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 415A. And one more to go here, one down, one to go. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 938.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 938, switching gears from cigarettes to property taxes. It would allow a county by ordinance or resolution to allow property tax exemption for newly constructed or installed industrial improvements. The qualifying industrial improvements must have a minimum real market value between $2 to $10 million, and the exemption is allowed for a period of 3 to 5 years at a declining percentage of assessed value. The language in the bill kind of sets standards, and then it goes on to require the county to specify the actual number of years, so it'd still be within that 3 to 5 year range, but the county would specify the number of years of the exemption, and then also the declining percentage to apply to the exemption. So that's left up to the county as well. It allows the county at any time to amend or terminate the exemption, but it would require industrial improvements receiving the exemption to continue to receive the exemption pursuant to the terms in effect at the time the exemption was first granted. So if a county chooses to terminate or adjust, those that are already receiving the exemption would continue to do so under the terms that they signed up or began receiving the exemption under. And it requires a county to grant the exemption on the same terms to all eligible industrial improvements. So it wouldn't be a case-by-case project, but it'd be set the parameters and then properties that qualify would all qualify, so long as they meet the qualifying requirements. The county may allow the exemption for property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2014, which does have a little retroactivity, and it take effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. And just on a note on the way the language is drafted right now, this is a committee bill, but there is it does apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2014, which is in the past. That language would be repealed from statute on January 2nd, 2017. But there may be, at that time, there could be some ambiguity in exactly what time period would be permitted under the exemption. So there could be a need for some clarifying language. In a number of other existing exemptions, there's often an application and a time period for the application to be received, and then the exemption's received after the application's received, assuming it's received on time and everything. So there may be a need for some sort of clarification language similar to what's in the existing statute for other exemptions to make sure this does apply to the years in which is the policy, I suppose.
Can I ask staff a question, Mr.
Sure,
Chair?
Senator Wright.
Does this only require counties and it doesn't require consultation like some of our other exemptions with the special districts and other tax recipients?
Yes, Senator Riley, it the way it's written right now, yeah, it is set up where it'd be the county would be the deciding, I guess, the decider on what how to allow the exemption, and then also they can set up the parameters so long as it's within the what's written in the law.
Thank you.
So, yes.
Okay. Normally we ask for a hypothetical from you, Kyle, at this point, but I think Jim Bernot has one, so why don't you come up here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for hearing this issue. We had this experience at Willamette Valley Vineyards when we did a remodel where our property taxes on just the piece of property that affects the winery building itself increased from $60,000 a year to $111,000 a year as the result of the remodel that we did. And what it struck me was and so over a 10-year period, that's $500,000. And for a small winery, that's a lot of money. And what struck me was the first problem for business is the investment we make in those assets won't provide a rate of return in its first year or second year or third year. It takes time for that rate of return to develop from the assets that you put into the new assets you put into place. And so a more rational tax policy would be one where you'd be able to pay your taxes on a more effective use of those assets over time. So you'd be able to graduate into the use of the assets as a result of the return that's received. But the other point that occurred to me was this, in a way, is found money in the tax base. In other words, the tax base is growing as a result of the investment that's being made by small businesses. And it's essentially found money to the taxing districts that collect from that tax base. And so my feeling was there's no harm if you encourage an investment in the tax base because you're increasing the base as a result of the risk-taking that's being taken by the small business owner. So there's no harm to the taxing district to allow this property tax to phase in over time. And so it was my personal experience with this issue that really led me to and how important giving the counties a tool like this to encourage rural investment would be. You know, I did hand out, you know, we're probably one of the smallest publicly held companies in the United States. And the reason for that, of course, is I worked my way through college in a sawmill in Roseburg and didn't have the money to build a world-class winery. So the way I did it was I got a whole lot of Oregonians to help me. And that's why we're one of the smallest publicly held companies in the United States. But because of that, we do report a lot of information on our quarterlies and annual financials. We're audited. And so what I've given you is I've given you a detail of the taxes that we pay. And I know that sometimes people see news accounts of corporations paying very small amount of taxes, but I wanted you to see ours. And this is publicly reported. We started in 83, planting in 83. I started making wine in 1989. And so I didn't start paying really any serious taxes until 1995. And so from 1995, you turn over the sheet of paper to 2013, you can see our gross revenues, our federal taxes, income and excise, licenses, our state taxes, local property tax, and then what the accumulated tax burden has been since 1995. And what's really instructive about the information that I'm providing you is that the accumulated taxes, and this is not payroll taxes, this is just the taxes of excise, property, and income. The accumulated taxes during the time we've been in business paying taxes is almost $13 million. The net income we've been able to keep from the result of our investment in our work is just a little over $10 million. So the point I'm trying to make is that from the investment we're making in our community, the risk-taking we're taking, the dollars we're investing, we actually have received less than the government agencies that tax us for the activities we're engaged in. And I just wanted you to be aware of what, at least in our case, our small winery, is paying in taxes. And so that's why we're really sensitive to these issues and how important it is to provide an opportunity to phase in the property tax burden as the investments are being put to work for us and for the community.
These are eye-opening figures, and they really are, just aside from the legislation. The goal here isn't to exempt a company from property taxes, but just to pay it off instead of one initial hit to get on a little bit of a timeline.
Yeah.
Senator Brookwitz.
Thank you. I'd like you to speculate here. Forget that you're Willamette now, because you're in the industry for as long as you have. We're trying to grow Oregon's rural industries, and wine is leading the way, whether we agree or disagree, but in the rural areas, that's the big thing. And you're now getting to a whole series of vineyards that are getting to the stage where they have a market, and they're, frankly, your competitors, but they're getting close to you. In looking across the state, you know, you're a member of all these associations. Do you see a lot of other wineries and a lot of other related spinoff industries that would be impacted by this bill?
I see a lot of opportunities in rural areas, not just in our industry, but other. You know, agriculture is in many ways is changing, and it's not just our industry. We're becoming far more integrated. We're taking products that we grow and we're turning them to value-added things that we sell to the customer in ways that we never used to do before. Wine is just an example of that. This is happening in agriculture all over. And there is an opportunity for us to grow our employment and our investments and as well as our tax base in these rural areas. And what I'm trying to suggest is that if the counties provide a way of recognizing to people who want to make that investment, hey, you know, we're not going to hit you all at once with the tax on that full investment. We're going to let you phase it in. I think you're going to encourage more investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burchard.
Thank you for coming and testifying today. I have a small business myself, and I'll be quite honest with you, the last few years looking at the tax burden and my silent partner, the government, it's you know, I'm starting to come to the conclusion that it's like, what am I doing? Who am I really working for? Who, you know? And I spent my whole life. I started when I was 18 with $300, you know. And so I look at your numbers, and I understand what you're going through. It is. It's frustrating. You wonder, what are you doing? What am I doing here? But I would like to point out in the bill, it says the counties may, so at least it gives them an option. It would be county by county. It gives them that option. But I appreciate you sharing this with us, because I take what the chair has said. It's an eye-opener. It really is.
You know, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, you know, as a small business owner, we do see that I think government has been very aggressive and very successful in encouraging investment of large companies. And I can see there's a logic to what they're doing. But I can tell you, as a small business owner, it's a bit frustrating to not even get the challenges that we face recognized. And that's why a phase in this bill actually requires a substantial investment. It's between $2 and $10 million. This is a substantial increase in investment to get at least a phase in recognized. So we can figure out how to earn a profit off of those capital those capital investments that we're taking the risk on implementing.
Senator Boquist?
No, I'm fully in support. This is basically a rural economic development, and it's completely permissive to the counties. I didn't quite follow all of Kyle's, you know, gyrations here, but obviously something would have to be fixed in this, and there's probably other concerns raised to be fixed. But it's once again a tool, and we were just yesterday debating for 5.5 hours if we had more jobs and more income, and we would have a bigger tax base. And I think that's what even the proponents of the bill are saying is, you want to grow the tax base, we need to at least provide. And this isn't a case, Mr. Chair, where we're saying, hey, we're going to give them something for free. We're basically ramping up here on this thing so that it's more doable, and especially in a time in which capital is hard to acquire for development. It's an interesting concept.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you. Jim, what year did you make your investment? You in your comments, you said we invested this much, and then the taxes went up this much, and I was just trying to track through on the local property tax row.
Yeah, the spreadsheet you have doesn't have my latest doesn't have the 2014 tax year, because we haven't finished our federal return, and so it only goes through 2013. The investment we made was in 2014.
Okay, and it jumped from
$59,123 to $111,062, and that's just on the one piece of property. We have a variety of vineyards, but this is just on that one piece. Okay. Where we made the remodel.
Thank you.
And you know how I'm sure a number of you have built homes or built businesses or buildings, and you know what happens when you first set a budget to build your. You know, we did our remodel. Our budget was originally $2 million. And then we moved it to $4 million, and then it got moved to $6 million.
It was like a state IT project.
And this is what happens when you're developing a business and refining the idea, and then being confronted with construction costs that you didn't originally anticipate. I mean, this is a common experience that we have, and so we didn't want to. If you've been out to see what we've done, we didn't want to make compromises to the quality experience we wanted to offer the guest. And so we went ahead and paid the price, but boy, we're really paying the price now.
Yeah. Senator Wright.
Thank you very much. A couple of comments. First of all, one of the things that I want to accomplish in this legislature is to make it sure that Senator Boquist can't make that same comment in the future. And I'm hoping that, you know, being chair of IT committee will help that. But secondly, this sounds to me like a good idea. I'm not sure about the details exactly, but the idea is a good idea. And this is exactly why I set up my Small Business Advisory Council, to hear ideas like this. And I think this is a good one. So I appreciate you coming forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you bringing this forward. Appreciate what you do there up on the Hill, too, what you've built. The League of Oregon Cities.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League has concerns with this bill. I think we all agree that cities need more economic development tools, and this idea may provide such a tool, but as it's written, we have concerns with the bill. First, as Senator Riley pointed out, this bill only requires a county to agree to what in a sense is a tax abatement. It doesn't require the cities or special districts or schools or anyone else who would be affected by this revenue loss to be a part of the agreement. So like the SIP agreements that you're very familiar with from this committee, this is only the county that would be making the decision. So that's a concern for us. We're in favor of local options for property tax exemptions, but this doesn't allow the cities to even come to the table. It just lets the county make that decision. And even worse, this bill is a retroactive provision. As you see in the bill on the second page on line one, it affects property taxes beginning on or after July 1st of 2014. So it's going backwards. So we would not have any part in that decision at all. Third, we're concerned about the stacking of exemptions. There are all kinds of other property tax exemptions that are available, and this bill doesn't address how those would work together. Fourth, As staff pointed out, once a county makes the decision to grant perhaps Willamette Valley Vineyards an exemption, they would be required to provide that exemption to anyone else meeting the same criteria. That's in Section 1, Sub 5, little b of the bill. And so we're really concerned about unintended consequences, especially as we look backwards, because it would provide, going back to 2014, what that would do. Budgets have already been set. Bills are being paid by cities, counties, special districts, and schools, and this would be providing an exemption looking backwards. Specifically looking at the language, Section 1, Line 5, this exemption would apply to industrial property. An industrial property is a finite group of property. Industrial property is assessed and valued by the Department of Revenue. That's only property that's greater than $1 million. So that's, last when I looked at the Department of Revenue's website, it looks like there's about 880 some properties that that would apply to, so across the state. So it is a narrower group, but we're just not sure how that would affect all of our local governments. The way the bill's written, it's not clear to me whether it's a full or a partial exemption, or it would allow counties to decide either. Is it is it all the value of the improvements, or is it just those over the 2 to 10 million? We're just not sure how this plays out, practically speaking. A lot of our other programs have that detail of how that would work. It's a range of between 2 and 10. Again, we're just not sure what that means practically. Each county gets to decide, and how is that going to be played out? On line 15, it says 3 to 5 years, which is the same for E-Zone, so there's some similarity in those programs. And so we already have the E-Zone program that perhaps this company could have used, and so we're just not sure why this program is necessary at this time. It sounded like from the conversation the committee had, as well as from Mr. Bruneau, that this was about a deferral and easing in the taxes. But the way I read it, and my colleagues read it, is that it's a straight abatement. It's not a deferral, because it says it's an exemption. That's on line 8. A deferral would make more sense if that's what you're trying to do, is spread those costs of these significant improvements. You could model it more like the homestead deferral for the elderly, if that's what you're really trying to do, is spread those payments out. But we rate it just as an exemption, and that's a concern. Let's see. There's this issue of vineyards and what exemptions apply to vineyards is not a new issue. In 1999, the Oregon Supreme Court, the King Estates case out of Lane County, addressed this issue of whether tasting rooms and all the equipment to process wine was fell under the exemptions, and the court held that it didn't. The legislature passed a bill to provide some exemptions for personal property, and the governor vetoed that bill in 1999. But there are exclusive farm use provisions and other agriculture type provisions for the real property that vineyards have available to them. And so we just don't understand how this is going to fit on top of the other exemptions that vineyards already have. And if this is to address all industrial property, that's one thing. But if the issue really is vineyards in Oregon, then the bill could be crafted much narrower to only focus on vineyards. But I think more work is needed to really address what the needs are because of all the existing programs and exemptions. So we would be in favor of looking at that narrower issue, and we think that would be the better approach as an economic development tool. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. How many vineyards are in cities?
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, I don't have that answer. I could try to look into it for you, but I'm just not aware. I know West Salem has quite a few.
Inside the city limits?
Pardon me?
Vineyards inside the city limits?
Senator Haas, Chair Boquist, I know we have some in Salem, but I don't have the number.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Boquist.
Another approach would be to just eliminate cities.
out of the bill.
Right. I mean, there's an approach there, too, to, you know, it only applies to properties that are outside city limits. I mean, that's another option to address the whole cities.
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, yeah, there are definitely other programs that allow opt-outs. The housing bills that are, I think they're in the House right now, those allow an opt-outs for local governments to not provide the exemption. We'd be in favor of that as well, either to allow us to opt in or to allow us to opt out. But this is clearly one district getting to decide the property taxes for all the rest.
Thank you.
questions? Gil Riddell from the counties, did you want to add to this? Did you want to? Okay.
Well, it's period. The microphones around the cities are eliminating themselves by the bill. Attrition right now.
Now, I might need to check this, but I do believe there are some wineries inside counties.
In counties, yes, indeed, Mr. Chair. And we're happy about that.
Yeah.
Very happy.
So are we. Especially
we're happy about Willamette Valley Vineyards, too. And for the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. We do not, as the discussion has proceeded, we were simply listening, but I think we have some information for the county to consider. And our commissioners and judges will be in town on Monday and tell us what to do about this bill, but we did this in preparation of that meeting. What you have before you is a comparison between the two very similar programs, the Senate Bill 938 and the Enterprise Zone. It struck us immediately how similar these were to these two were. So we went through the exercise yesterday of comparing them side by side, and and I think these questions need to be asked and answered by the committee and considered. If you start at the second bullet, I'll go through these very quickly, but I think they're informative. The Enterprise Zone requires a sponsor local government, which could be a city, county, or port, to consult with affected local taxing districts before the zone is set. Senate Bill 938 does not require consultation, nor does it grant the exemption of property taxes of any other local government except the county. I don't see any authorization in the bill of any kind that would permit the county by itself to draw on taxes of other local districts that would affect a particular property. That at least should be clarified. Third bullet, the Enterprise Zone is the choice of the sponsor county, and the county also, as a sponsor, can set the area of coverage and expand it if it wishes. Senate Bill 938 is also choice of the county, but it applies to one classification of property, that's industrial, and it applies to the entire county, whether the county wants it to or not. Fourth bullet, the Enterprise Zone is before the investment is made, and this is for ease and efficiency of administration and a clear understanding of what the expectations are of the business in the Enterprise Zone. Senate Bill 938 requires the county to grant an exemption on the same terms as all eligible industrial improvements in the county, so there's no ability for the county to target development in a particular part of its county. Also, the bill is retroactive, you've heard that, and for where that is in effect, the county assessor will be forced to do the more burdensome amendment of the tax roll, go back, recoup taxes from taxing districts after they've been distributed. We understand the reason for the retroactive clause and know it's a critical element here and understand that. Next bullet, the Enterprise Zone requires public interest quid pro quo. That is, a business has to create at least one full-time job, and to get the fourth and fifth year, must pay the new employees at least 150% wages of 150% of the county average wage. This is determined before investment, again, for the smooth administration. This bill does not require any job creation or a minimum level of wage at all. The Enterprise Zone has a sponsor. The sponsor will work with the assessor, the Business Oregon, and Department of Revenue to assure smooth operation. Senate Bill 938 requires the county ordinance to specify improvements. That improvements must, as we read it, must raise the real market value of the property at a minimum of between $2 million and $10 million as determined by the ordinance. It's got to fall within that range, the additional value that's produced by the investment. The bill requires the ordinance to specify the number of years the exemption is allowed, from 3 to 5, and the percentage of annual exemption, and as Jim Bernot pointed out, it's declining a percentage of exemption so that the business will phase into a more productive phase. And because of that annual decline in the exemption, it's likely if a business has thought about this beforehand and has worked with the county or some other sponsor create or expand an enterprise zone, that exemption is total. That's all of the taxing districts and would likely benefit far more than under Senate Bill 938. In terms of your question about counties, I noticed that the list of enterprise zones provided by Business Oregon, Lincoln County has its entire county as an enterprise zone. Malheur has its entire county. Sherman, Tillamook, and let's see who else, Baker County, Crook County, Harney County, Grant County, Gillum County, Jackson County, Jefferson County. So there are those counties that are sponsors that have taken the entire county as the enterprise zone. Marion County has five enterprise zones. Four appear to be outside of city limits, or rather, they're anchored by a smaller city, and we understand that they could indeed be expanded if the county wished to do that. But the county's not a sponsor of any of them. They're just they're a participant for some reason. They have not chosen to sponsor any by themselves. Ports have 10, and tribal governments have 2. So it's an excellent – the enterprise zone has served beautifully. It provides more benefits to the business as in summary, it requires working with other taxing districts, but it also provides an exemption of the entirety of the local taxing districts within the enterprise zone. This other bill, in comparison, has contrasts and similarities. It has a provision that is needed by the advocate, but these are the kind of questions we're going to consult with our folks on Monday and see what they want to do. We're very, very supportive of incentives for business growth, I can give you examples of us of counties giving up money in taxes for the incentive that would provide, if it's convincing and if it's needed. So we're not anti-growth at all, and only focused on our revenues, although counties, I think, are the level of government that right now is struggling the most with the lack of revenues for really critical services like public safety. So that's the end of my comments. It's just for your information.
So if I understood all of this, you're going to get back to us.
Yes, indeed, if you wish.
Right, because follow up, Mr. Chair. Because what we're trying to do is create tools for counties, and they're permissive tools for counties.
Yes.
And as you've just pointed out, and you've listed, rattled off some counties which are trying to, are struggling to figure out how to get more people to come in and develop and do stuff. And this is not like some of our programs where you get an exemption for 25 years and so on and so forth. The goal here is to ramp up and go out.
That's right.
And then provide the tool to the county to do that. So.
Yes.
I'm frankly looking for solutions because I am frustrated, as you can tell, with the cities, even my own cities, in which they talk a lot, and I even have counties who talk a lot, but then when it comes to execution phase, they're not willing to go out and do anything, and so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, they're dying on their own grapevines, actually, and that's the problem we have. And, I earlier this session, Mr. Chair, I pushed another concept out, and, everybody from the cities and counties and all kinds of other people, and I'm not saying cities and counties organizations, pushbacks, well, no, we don't want to do this. And it's like, well, then what do you want to do? I mean, you keep coming to the state saying, give us more money. We don't have more money. We keep saying, do more development. And then they say, we don't have the tools. And when you're trying to offer the tools, what we need is consensus among cities, counties, districts, and everything else is how do we build the economy, rural Oregon, back? Because just out of reality, I'm thinking that most of the metropolitan areas are now out of space. So we got to do something.
Mr. Chair, may I respond? Senator Boquist, I assume you use the word execution in terms of implementation. As
exactly.
Okay.
I'm retired.
I appreciate what you say. Remember, though, that more development means an increased need for public services. So that's the tension that counties feel. More development, but who's going to – how many – sheriff deputy patrols do we have out in the country to be able to protect those places? So
none. It's not noon.
Exactly. So I'm glad you understand that, and that's what we're struggling with.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one clarification. At one point in your discussion, you said that you didn't see that this allowed you to affect the other agencies' tax basis. But at another point, when you were talking about the retroactivity, you said it would require the tax assessors and collectors to go back and get money from those other agencies that they'd already distributed. Which is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wright, that's a very good point. That's a good catch. I think the assessor would have to do that anyway, even with respect to one agency. But that's a question I think that you ought to have Legislative Council clarify, because I think the bill intends to affect all districts, but I don't believe it does. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Gil.
Thank you.
I have David Roth, tax fairness. Would you like to testify? We're closing down, and then we have one more after you, so.
I'll be brief.
Thanks.
Thank you. Short bill, short comment. Pardon me. My name is David Roth. I'm a volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon. I want to thank the chair, Senator Haas, and vice chair for giving me the opportunity to testify concerning this bill. The bill is a scaled down version of the SIP statute, which requires very large investments and extends property tax breaks over many years. In this bill, the range of qualified investment is $2 million to $10 million, and the duration is 3 to 5 years. At this scale, we anticipate the program could be very popular. It's fortunate that the duration of the agreements is limited to 5 years, but we need to see projections of its impact over the life of the program before we could support it. We don't want another, might be a small Betsy. Unfortunately, the bill makes no mention of schools' interests in the property tax exemptions. The authority to negotiate property tax limitations is put entirely in the hands of the county, as so many others here seem to think. Why are we giving away local school taxes to encourage business growth in this state? Both Democrats and Republicans are arguing that the initial funding level of the state's school budget is inadequate. We know that the state is responsible for making up for any inequalities in local school revenues. We've also heard Oregon business leaders complain over the last decade that Oregon is not putting enough funds into education, either lower or higher. Given that consensus, isn't it time to say to business investors that they can't have it both ways, more tax breaks and more education? TFO won't support this bill unless it exempts local school taxes from these business incentives. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Bill Cross.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of Willamette Valley Vineyards. And I just wanted to comment that we did look at enterprise zones and have tried to figure out what kind of opportunity there might be. Enterprise zones over the years have been fairly restrictive, limited in number, and I understand there is legislation that's being considered that would eliminate the cap on enterprise zones, but there's conditions that go with those enterprise zones. For example, requiring a company to go through PACs or agreements with local community colleges for training purposes, and that may not be appropriate for the kind of scenarios I think we're looking at. I think we heard that there's 880 of these industrial property types out there, and we were trying to figure out a way to enable counties to look at those opportunities, typically more rural, where we're not picking up through the enterprise zones and we're not picking up the large the SIP kinds of projects, but something where they'd have some ability to look at a different way to and it was called an exemption, but we were in our minds looking at a way to escalate the taxes to their full amount, but starting with a reduction in the first 3 to 5 years. I took this concept to legislative council, and so I'll take part of the blame or the criticism in terms of not exactly knowing whether all the taxing districts are impacted by this bill. I talked to legislative council. They said the way it's written, it would, but that's a policy consideration that, you know, we're happy to work with the committee and others in terms of determining how best to allow the county to interact with the other taxing districts, and whether there are other conditions of approval that would make counties feel, we just wanted to make sure it wasn't discriminatory, so to speak, that there be some policies that a county could look at in terms of economic development and how to encourage that. So we'd be happy to entertain recommendations on how it could constructively move forward. Appreciate your time today.
And Senator Bocas and I will work with you to maybe do some refinements.
Yeah, I'd be happy to head up a small work group if we need to do that. If you're willing to go forward.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, gentlemen, thank you for your patience. It's 10 o'clock. This is exactly how I planned this out to go to 10 o'clock. So thank you all. We are adjourned.